you live in a world that you have, and you cannot keep on hoping for a better world. So you struggle and you struggle, but Ethiopia, apart from some terrible blunders in Somalia, for example, when it invaded and destroyed a very moderate Islamic Courts Union, which seemed to be bringing peace to Somalia in 2006, with U.S. help, of course. So Ethiopia is ahead of the seat of the African Union, and a very, very important player, the second largest population in Africa. So it's a tough call for Obama, knowing what he's trying to do in the U.S., making major changes in so many U.S. policies, and yet on this issue of terrorism, I think he's not got the right message. Basically, don't have a vision of the world. I mean, that's one of the greatest problems we have in the world at the moment. It's that the West, especially the U.S., has no vision for how to address.
Salim Lone, we're going to have to leave it there. Kenyan journalist as well as Agri Mutombo speaking to us from Nairobi. That does it for our broadcast. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
Cebu Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the summer concert in Dawson Park, featuring a live performance by Bamba Isupilon Dasukar Band on Wednesday, July 29th at 6:30 p.m. The mission of Summer Concerts in the Park is to bring cultural diversity to metropolitan area residents. Bamba Isupilon Dasukar Band play a full range of popular and traditional salsa, son cubano, timba, and tropical styles as cumbia, merengue, y bachata. Again, that's the Summer Concert in Dawson Park with Bamba Isupilon Dasukar Band on Wednesday, July 29th at 6:30 p.m. Dawson Park is located at North Stanton and North Williams Avenue in Portland. More information about ticket prices and directions can be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
Cebu Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Matt Dishman Community Center annual block party on Saturday, August 8th from noon to 4 p.m. This family-friendly event will include barbecue grub, live music and a DJ, activities for kids, family swim in the pool, local vendors, and more. Again, that's the Matt Dishman Community Center annual block party on Saturday, August 8th from noon to 4 p.m. at Matt Dishman Community Center, 77 Northeast Knott Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, attendees of the first annual Black Lives Matter conference in Cleveland were pepper-sprayed by transit officials.
Salmon in the Columbia River are dying at an increasingly high rate this summer due to higher-than-normal temperatures.
And 2 weeks after Sandra Bland's death in a Texas prison, an African-American woman was found dead in a Cleveland prison.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, July 27th, 2015. I'm Rosalind Scott.
And I'm Ken Jones. A Cleveland regional transit officer pepper-sprayed attendees of the first annual Black Lives Matter conference on Saturday when participants attempted to prevent police officers from arresting a 14-year-old African-American boy. Witnesses reported that the boy, who officers claim was intoxicated and incapable of taking care of himself, was slammed to the ground and handcuffed before being led to a patrol car. The crowd of conference attendees surrounded the patrol car with arms linked and prevented it from leaving with the 14-year-old, prompting the police to try pushing them back. At one point, members of the crowd tried to pull the boy from the patrol car. He was able to relay his home number to a protester, who then called his mother and informed her of what was happening. After a short, tense standoff, one police officer fired pepper spray multiple times at the crowd. The boy was then taken to nearby paramedics and was released to his mother when she showed up about an hour later. The crowd was jubilant after the police released the boy, claiming that this outcome was a demonstration of the community's power to defend itself against police bodies seen as discriminatory and abusive.
Less than 2 weeks after Sandra Bland died in a Texas jail cell, another black woman was found dead in a jail cell in Cleveland. Ralkeena Jones, a 37-year-old Cleveland resident, died Wednesday while in custody at the Cleveland Heights jail facility. Jones was arrested on Friday after an argument with her ex-husband and placed in a jail cell. Jones's sister, Renee Ashford, said that Jones was, quote, perfectly fine when she visited her in jail on Saturday. Here's a clip of Renee Ashford speaking on a YouTube video today.
She went to jail overnight. I went to see her day before yesterday in jail. You know, she had to get her medication and I was coming to visit her. She was perfectly fine. She didn't complain of nothing, saying like she was hurting or nothing. She was fine. I just seen her. And then the next day they called and said she was dead in jail. They checked on her, but it's like they won't tell us nothing.
One thing I can say about my sister is she would want us to find out why. Just why. Like, you can't just tell me one minute I see my sister, then the next day she dead. That don't even make sense. And it's just, I can't help you. I can't tell you.
A nearby hospital due to problems with her blood pressure and blood sugar. She was evaluated and returned to jail Saturday night, and her vitals were observed to be normal early the following morning. Jones was found dead in her jail cell during a routine check at 7:35 a.m. on Sunday morning. Her family said she had never been arrested before. Jones's sister said she had health issues and that she carried a list of those problems with her everywhere she went. The local medical examiner's office confirmed today that an autopsy had been performed, but did not release the results of that autopsy.
Last week, President Obama visited the El Reno facility in Oklahoma, becoming the first sitting president to visit a federal correctional facility. For years, United Nations officials with mandates from the Geneva-based Human Rights Council have been denied entrance. In 1998, a UN Special Rapporteur on Violence Against Women representative was blocked by Governor John Engler at the last minute from visiting three Michigan prisons. The representative was investigating sexual misconduct against women prisoners in spite of extensive advanced preparation to interview inmates. Obama's visit has given hope to the United Nations for another try at visiting the U.S. prison system. In Obama's visit, he stated that too many men and boys of color are treated differently at these facilities. The UN Special Rapporteur on Torture and the chairperson of the Working Group on Arbitrary Detention are requesting permission to visit U.S. prisons in an effort to advance criminal justice reform. Over 80,000 inmates in the U.S. are in solitary confinement for months and sometimes years, which inflicts pain and suffering of a psychological nature and is prohibited by the Convention Against Torture. In response to reports of unhealthy living conditions and beating specifically against minorities, the United Nations investigations, if allowed by the Obama administration, will help ensure oversight over the U.S. prison system.
A group of kayaktivists took to the Willamette River in Portland this past weekend to try to block the entry of a damaged icebreaker ship owned by the Shell Oil Company. The ship is in Portland to repair a break in the hull. Once repaired, the icebreaker will head north to the Arctic to begin the first oil drilling operation in the fragile ecosystem of the Arctic Circle. Environmental groups recently conducted a study based on past performance by oil companies drilling in similar conditions and found that there is a 70% likelihood of a major oil spill resulting from Arctic drilling. The repair of the icebreaker is the last step before Shell can begin drilling in the Arctic. KBOO's Jimmy Tardy was at the action on Saturday and brings us the sound of the protest, beginning with a message from the icebreaker rig, the USC Finica, telling the kayaktivists to identify themselves and stop impeding the process of the ship.
Please confirm the identity of the master of your vessel and the identities of all crew members. By approaching, you are interfering with the navigation and safe operation of this vessel and support vessels by restricting our ability to maneuver. Your conduct is dangerous and a potential hazard to the safety of my crew and yourselves. Your approach reflects poor seamanship and it is completely contrary to the rules of the road. Please desist from obstructing our navigation. Please leave the vicinity of the installation and ensure that you do not infringe the 100-yard safety zone of this vessel.
We are so grateful and humbled by people like you coming out and defending not only the Arctic, but defending the justice for our seas. The womb of our mothers, when we come out as individuals, it's the same salinity as that ocean out there that provides life. That is us. We are the defenders of our mothers. Thank you. Goyana Teluchi.
Well, I think we want to wake up the Obama administration. You know, we want the president to secure his climate legacy by stopping Arctic drilling. We don't want him to be the president that opened up the Arctic Ocean to oil drilling.
We are blocking one of Shell's icebreakers currently to show them what they are doing is wrong, and because we want to defend the future generations and make sure they live in a good world because we want to defend the Arctic and help future generations. It's a pretty big risk for Shell. They have plenty of oil already and they're only going to need this in quite a few years, and oil should be kept in the ground. It's not good for the planet to take it out and burn it. It's not good for our environment.
That was a 13-year-old protester who participated in a kayak blockade of a Shell oil ship this weekend. Activists say they expect the ship to leave Portland as early as this Wednesday. Another kayak blockade is planned for tomorrow. Daphne Wysham, one of the organizers, spoke on KBOO's Air Cascadia this morning.
We are preparing for a major action tomorrow, Tuesday at noon, lasting as long as necessary. We are gathering at the Cathedral Park boat ramp. This is because we expect Shell's icebreaker to depart on Wednesday morning. So we want everybody who cares about this issue to go down to the water. The point of going down there is to hold a water vigil to celebrate what's really sacred, which is the water, a stable climate, and our stories. So we urge everybody who wants to be involved, you can text this number, 23559. You just text to that and hit at Shell No PDX, and you will be part of our rapid response text loop, and you'll stay up to date on all the latest information on this vigil. That includes media, that includes any activists that want to be down there. Again, for your listeners, if you haven't had a chance to grab a pen, it's you want to text 23559 and send the message at symbol Shell No PDX, NOPDX. So in terms of the issue, I'd like to really draw attention to the role that the United States, and in particular high energy consumers in the United States, have played in creating the climate crisis. I mean, up until very recently, it was the U.S. that was the number one polluter, and now China has surpassed us. We really need to lead by example here in the United States if we expect other countries to do the same. As we know, the journal Nature reported that to maintain even a 50% chance of avoiding catastrophic global warming, which is, some people say it's at 2 degrees Celsius. Others say we've already surpassed very dangerous levels when we're just approaching 1 degree Celsius. But even to maintain a 50% chance of avoiding catastrophic global warming, we cannot drill in the Arctic. We need to leave two-thirds of all fossil fuels in the ground by 2050. This is not according to Greenpeace. This is according to the International Energy Agency. And another study that hasn't gotten nearly the amount of press that it should have is NASA's former top climate scientist, Dr. James Hansen, said just a couple weeks ago in a study that we could see 10 feet of sea level rise by the middle of this century, inundating Portland. In fact, ironically, the port where the Seneca is being repaired right now would be underwater. So we absolutely need to turn this around. Here in the United States, we need to stop exporting all of this oil, gas, and coal that's planned for the Pacific Northwest. We know that 5 times the Keystone XL pipeline's carbon content is planned for export from our ports. And the Climate Action Coalition, which I'm a part of, has taken a very strong stand against this. We are calling for no new fossil fuel infrastructure. We've been joined by the Ecumenical Ministries of Oregon in taking this stand, and we encourage everybody who cares about the future of this planet to join us.
That was Daphne Wisham, of Climate Action Coalition in Portland. More information can be found on the website 350pdx.org.
About half of the 500,000 sockeye salmon returning to the Columbia River this summer have died or are dying from low oxygen levels in the waters. Low levels of oxygen are caused by unusually high water temperatures, temperatures that often reach into the high 70s due to low water levels, and surface temperatures frequently near 100 degrees. The fish, which swim up the Columbia River from the Pacific Ocean to spawn, become stressed at water temperatures of 68 degrees and stop migrating upstream completely at 74 degrees. Officials from the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration predicted that despite having a larger-than-expected sockeye return, 80% of the returning fish could perish from the warmer waters. There are a few options available to fishery management teams to cool the river waters to healthy levels, but one of these is releasing cold water from select reservoirs upstream to try and bring temperatures down in time for the Chinook salmon and steelhead, which migrate later in the summer. Oregon fishery biologists say more than 100 spring Chinook died earlier this summer when temperatures in the John Day River reached the mid-70s. Both Oregon and Washington have enacted sport fishing closures due to the warm water.
In related news, the Oregon Board of Forestry has delayed a decision on whether to expand the no-logging buffers around streams in Oregon, despite the fact that these buffers help keep streams cool enough for salmon. After 4 years of consideration, the board was scheduled to vote on the rule updates in Salem on Thursday, but said it needed more time. Timber owners are trying to minimize the logging restrictions while conservation and sport fishing business groups are pushing to maximize protections for salmon. Current rules require zone buffers of 20 feet on small to medium streams. Buffers up to 100 feet are being considered. The bigger the buffers, the more shade and the greater the chance of meeting the cold water standard. But this has a greater economic impact on the timber industry. A Department of Forestry spokesman said the board formed a subcommittee to make recommendations that will be considered this fall. The delay in the decision on expanding logging buffers comes as record hot temperatures and drought have been killing Oregon salmon at higher rates this year.
The deadline's been extended for drivers in Oregon who paid a debit card fee at ARCO gas stations to participate in a class action lawsuit against the company. ARCO illegally charged a 35-cent fee on gas purchases from 2011 to 2013. Up to 2 million people who paid these fees will be eligible for around $160 each in damages if the lawsuit's successful. For more, KBOO's Jenka Soderberg spoke with the lead attorney in the case, David Sugarman.
Could you talk about what this lawsuit is and who would qualify?
Yeah, hi. So the lawsuit is a claim for unlawful trade practices involving overcharging for gasoline. It arose between the dates of January 1, 2011, and August 30, 2013. And during that time period, people who bought gas at an ARCO station and paid with a debit card were charged an illegal fee of 35 cents a person. And this happened about 13,000 times a day in Oregon. The debit card charge was illegal. We filed a lawsuit. I was appointed lead counsel for the class of about 2 million consumers who were illegally charged this fee. And the case went to trial in 2014, and the jury concluded that BP had illegally charged this fee and acted recklessly. Under Oregon law, consumers are entitled to $200 a person, and that number is adjusted for attorney fees. So this is a continuation of the claim process. There's already been an initial claim process, but we needed to reopen it.
So there's potentially 2 million people who could receive a one-time payment out of this settlement. Looks like about $164. How are those people being contacted?
So we already contacted about 1.7 million of them. A lot of KBOO listeners affected by this may have gotten a letter. It would have happened probably last year or early this, in which they were told about the case. And they were told that they could get this money, and they didn't have to do anything. We were able to do that because we were able to use the electronic data from the transaction records and subpoena names and addresses from a lot of the banks. We found over 80% of the group, about 1.7 million, and already sent them letters. If you got a letter, you don't need to do anything. But there are some people we couldn't get their bank records. Their banks wouldn't comply. Maybe their banks are out of state. Maybe the information got lost. And those folks need to file claims.
And any idea how this debit card charge was put in place at the ARCO gas stations? Was this a company-wide policy that was just mistaken? They didn't know the law, or was it an attempt to actually make extra money?
They did know about the law because they had been sued once before for the exact same violation. The law was different then. It wasn't nearly as favorable to consumers, but the same overcharge problem existed, and that was a case that was about 10 years before this one. They knew that they could make money on this debit card charge, and so they were.
Well, again, if people think they may have bought gas at an ARCO with a debit card between 2011 and 2013, the website is debitcardclassaction.com. Again, I've been speaking with David Sugarman. He's the lead attorney for the case against BP, which was the owner of ARCO at the time. The lawsuit is called Sharfstein versus BP West Coast Products, LLC. This is Jenka Soderberg with KBOO News.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for audio from Obama's trip to Africa. This will be followed by an update from injured workers and ex-workers of General Motors who have been camping outside of the U.S. Embassy in Bogota, Colombia for the last 4 years on Labor Radio at 6. At 6:30, Adam Carpinelli interviews Daniel Hong and Michael Wilson of Strike Debt on Prison Pipeline. At 7, it's River Signal, hosted by Aaron Yank. Tomorrow, weather is partly cloudy with a 10% chance of rain. The high is 87, the low is 59. Today in history, in 1919, the worst of the race riots during Chicago's Red Summer begins. The riot started after an African-American citizen of the city was hit by a rock and died at an informally segregated beach. The rioting lasted for 5 days and claimed the lives of 38 people. In 1974, the House of Representatives Judiciary Committee votes to recommend the first article of impeachment for President Richard Nixon.
It's 5:25, time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
By a one-vote margin, the U.S. Senate passed fast-track authority to expedite passage of the disastrous Trans-Pacific Partnership deal, which will export beaucoup more of our country's middle-class jobs. That's the kind of pro-corporate stupidity the Republican Congress specializes in these days. But wait! The key votes for the fast track came from a baker's dozen of Senate Democrats. Fast track is a railroad job to enthrone global corporate power over us. It will allow the Obama administration to send the massive 12-country trade scam to Congress for an up or down vote with little debate and no amendments allowed. Details of this thing are being negotiated in strict secrecy between top government officials and top executives of some 500 global corporations. Workers, consumers, and all the rest of us are shut out. The majority of Americans oppose this giveaway, so what's with the 13 turncoat Democrats? Not to worry, they say. Trade benefits everyone. Do they think we have sucker wrappers around our heads? Americans know that these trade schemes make the super rich richer, while the incomes of practically everyone else go south. There's still a chance to defeat the TPP because a gritty, well-organized populist coalition is rallying grassroots opposition to reject this raw deal. To join the fight, go to citizen.org/trade. This is Jim Hightower saying, and don't forget the 13 Democratic sellouts. If any one of them had stood with the people on the fast-track vote, we would have already derailed TPP. The 13 senators who said nuts to you are Michael Bennett, Maria Cantwell, Tom Carper, Chris Coons, Dianne Feinstein, Heidi Heitkamp, Tim Kaine, Claire McCaskill, Patty Murray, Bill Nelson, Gene Shaheen, Mark Warner, and Ron Wyden.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit hightowerlowdown.org.
The governing board of the Boy Scouts of America, headed by former Defense Secretary Robert Gates, is expected to lift a ban today on openly gay employees and scoutmasters. While lifting of the ban would be a major victory for the Boy Scouts of America, church-sponsored troops will still have the ability to discriminate against gay scout leaders. KBOO's Eric Tagadoff spoke to Jeff McGrath, an openly gay scoutmaster in Seattle, about the Boy Scouts' upcoming decision.
First off, I was wondering if you could just tell us a little bit about the lifting of the ban on gay scout leaders today, the decision that was made.
Right. So about a little over a year ago, our scout group was part of the Boy Scouts of America, and they revoked the charter for Troop 98 and PAC 98, which canceled the organization and the membership through the Boy Scouts of America to about 13 kids in our area. Today, we're expecting a decision from the National BSA Council that will rescind their decision to not permit LGBT adults from being participants in Boy Scouting. And that's a major departure. For generations, adults have been discriminated against and kids have not had the access to adult role models, especially the LGBT kids. That said, this is a new discrimination policy that they're adopting. Basically, they've decided that they will no longer discriminate in employment at the council office, but that individual units that are chartered by religious organizations can continue to discriminate.
Yeah, and I'm wondering what that means when certain churches may be able to still discriminate against scout leaders.
Well, actually, all churches will be able to. They're free to, according to this new rule set. And 71% of all units in the Boy Scouts of America are religiously sponsored. Boy Scouts of America has not committed to publishing a list of those units that will not discriminate, or the alternative, which is a list of units to avoid. And that's a problem. You know, kids grow up in a scout troop, and eventually they come to realize that they might be lesbian or gay or transgender, and they already are members of that troop. And it's important that basically all leaders in scouting have some sort of training and preparation for that, and learn how to treat everyone equally with equal dignity.
Will the scout meetings be able to be held in churches if there is a ban by that church on gay scout leaders?
Well, currently what the churches are free to do is actually to dismiss that scout leader and remove that person then from their scouting community, which would be naturally disruptive to the troop. Under the new policy, they'll still be able to do that.
Okay. So it's a certain victory, but also not a complete victory.
It's an important step, but it is one step in the road towards non-discrimination. It's not a non-discrimination policy, which every other national respected child-serving organization has. They have robust non-discrimination policies. Boy Scouts of America, even with this change, continues to really have a discrimination policy.
And what was the exact reasoning, just to go back a little bit, what was the exact reasoning for the Boy Scouts of America to come to this decision?
The reason that they communicated in the materials they circulated in this past month has been specifically related to the legal pressure that individual scouts and volunteers have brought to bear. For instance, the Greater New York Council had decided that they were no longer going to practice discrimination in their hiring practice for a scout camp, and so they went ahead and hired Pascal Tessier, who was the nation's first Eagle Scout under the new discrimination policy of last year. And in supporting and defending him as being the right young adult to staff their scout camp, they said to National that, National, you must change your policies, and we will stand up for this kid.
Why do you think it's taken the Boy Scouts of America so long to come to this decision?
There's probably lots of reasons. The thing that concerns me the most, at least in their communications regarding this, is that they don't talk about the actual needs of youth and their families. They talk a lot about their corporate prerogatives and that they want to respect the church's ability to continue to discriminate. But they really, if they would focus on the real needs of kids and their families and their desire of most people everywhere to treat everyone equally, I think that they would be able to put this matter entirely behind them.
Okay, thank you very much for that.
Thank you very much for your questions and your interest. This matters to kids and families, and soon I think BSA will be able to adopt a truly appropriate policy that is right for the entire nation.
For KBOO, this is Eric Tegedoff. I've been speaking to Jeff McGrath of the Boy Scouts of America.
The U.S. Justice Department said today that convicted Israeli spy Jonathan Pollard is set to be released on parole on November 21st, unless the parole board objects. Pollard was arrested in 1985 and given a life sentence in 1987 for espionage. At the time, he was a civilian analyst with the U.S. Navy. The case has long been a source of tension between the U.S. and Israel, which has argued that a life sentence for spying on behalf of a close U.S. partner is too harsh. Israel has for years sought Mr. Pollard's early release, only to be rejected by the U.S. There's speculation that the move will help smooth U.S. relations with Israel in the wake of the recent Iran nuclear deal. Pollard is 60 years old and currently serving his sentence in a federal prison in North Carolina. Under sentencing laws at the time he was convicted, Pollard has to be considered for parole after 30 years. November 21st marks 30 years since Pollard was first jailed. This date has for years been listed as his potential release date on the Bureau of Prisons website. As of that date, the burden shifts to the parole commission to show why Pollard does not deserve parole. Pollard's chances for release appear to be improved under the criteria by which the parole commission may object to mandatory parole: his behavior in prison and the likelihood he will commit another crime. Pollard has explained his spying by citing a great fondness for Israel, though U.S. officials said he was paid tens of thousands of dollars for his work. From June 1984 through November 1985, Pollard made copies of highly classified U.S. intelligence and delivered it to Israeli contacts. The U.S. has previously considered releasing Pollard, but always backed away, largely because of opposition from senior leaders at the CIA, the FBI, and the Justice Department. When Pollard was sentenced, then-Defense Secretary Caspar Weinberger said it was hard to imagine a greater harm to national security than that caused by Pollard.
And now we hear the latest in worker-related news from our friends at laborradio.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. The UAW is having a busy summer. In addition to bargaining a new auto contract at GM, Ford, and Fiat Chrysler, the union has also just opened bargaining for 17,000 Michigan State workers. The UAW's Ed Mitchell says the UAW, the largest Michigan State employee union, wants Michigan to prosper and for UAW members to share in the value of the hard work it takes to keep the state running efficiently. What's outrageous? Apparently living wages. Dunkin' Donuts CEO Nigel Travis, who gets approximately $4,889 an hour, says that $15 an hour for low-wage food industry workers in New York is outrageous. Absolutely outrageous. But lest you think of Travis as some greedy cretin from a century or two ago who doesn't believe in living wages for workers, he wants to set you straight. He would be perfectly okay with $12 an hour, since he thinks that is a realistic living wage. Problem is, Dunkin' Donuts pays workers an average of $8.99 an hour. So in Dunkin' Donuts CEO Nigel Travis's world, $4,889 an hour for the boss is just fine, while paying workers $15 an hour is somehow bad. He says it would prevent Dunkin' Donuts from hiring new workers. But Nigel could fix that problem himself. He could drop his pay to $150 an hour and use the rest to hire 315 more workers. In the WIN Sports Minute, Mitch Lawrence says, despite positive reviews for LeBron James's performance in the film Trainwreck, it's hard to beat Becky Hammons's real-life performance.
James has gotten a lot of positive reviews, but when it comes to trying out a new profession and succeeding, it's hard to beat what Becky Hammon is doing. Hammon is a former WNBA player who now is a full-time assistant with the San Antonio Spurs. This summer, she made history. She was the first female to coach a team in the NBA's Las Vegas Summer League, and she's the first female coach to win it, as she guided the Spurs to a 6-1 record. In light of her success, NBA Commissioner Adam Silver said he has, quote, no doubts, unquote, that one day a woman will be coaching an NBA team. Now, there's even talk that Hammond will be the one to break the NBA's glass ceiling, but everyone needs to remember that she's not even a lead assistant with the Spurs. Hammond sits in the second row, behind head coach Greg Popovich and his trio of top assistants. Also remember this, it's not easy to get one of the 30 NBA head coaching jobs. Just ask someone like Patrick Ewing, a former superstar with the New York Knicks and a longtime assistant who is still looking for his first head coaching gig. But it's certainly great to see that the NBA is already thinking about putting a woman in the ultimate position of power. With a Sports Minute for Workers Independent News, this is Mitch Lawrence.
Brought to you by the IBEW, 750,000 men and women powering the way for an American comeback. Information on how to become an International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers Power Professional is online at ibew.org.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
The search for 43 missing students in the Mexican state of Guerrero has turned up at least 60 graves and 129 bodies, according to Mexico's Attorney General's office. A large number of people have gone missing in the state of Guerrero, where violence from the drug war is widespread. More than 20,000 people are listed as missing in Mexico. The Attorney General of the country admitted the number of mass graves in Guerrero could be higher than 60 because the Associated Press could only count graves in which mass grave specialists got involved. Yesterday marked the 10th month since the students went missing. The grim anniversary was marked in Mexico City by several hundred protesters and led by parents of the missing students.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Ethan Martin, Ken Jones, and Rosalind Scott. The producer is Eric Tegedoff. Special thanks to Jimmy Tardy. Our engineer is Danielle Parks. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Jenka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews or look for us on Twitter at KBOO News. If you'd like to call your elected representatives about any issue you've heard on the news tonight, here are the phone numbers, so get a pen. The local number for Senator Ron Wyden is 503-326-7525. The number for Senator Jeff Merkley is 503-326-3386. Oregon Governor Kate Brown's number is 503-378-3111. Portland Mayor Charlie Hales can be reached at 503-823-4120. You're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River 91.9 FM. I'm Ken Jones.
And I'm Rosalind Scott. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO, at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, hear the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show with Abe Proctor and Joe Uris. At 9 on Alternative Radio, professor, author, and activist Cornel West speaks on love and justice. At 10, Air Cascadia is off today. We'll hear Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. At 11 on Stage and Studio, host DeMay Roberts talks to actress Jacqueline Maddox about meeting a challenge to write for 5 days about her acting career in New York City and Portland. And at 11:30 on Art Focus, host Joseph Gallivan interviews Dawson Carr, the curator of European art at the Portland Art Museum, about the show Gods and Heroes. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. Not a member? You can be one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today. President Obama is currently in Africa. Although he's been to Africa 4 times as president, this is his first trip to Kenya and Ethiopia. The Los Angeles Times reports the U.S. has stepped up use of drone strikes in neighboring Somalia ahead of Obama's trip. Stay tuned now for more on U.S. drone strikes and covert operations in Somalia as KBOO's Jenka Soderberg speaks with Abayomi Azwaki from the Pan American Newswire. Good night, Ken.
Good night, Rosalind. Good night, Danielle.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
We are joined on the line now by Abayomi Azakiwe. He is with the Pan-African Newswire in Detroit. And I wonder if you could tell us about what you think President Obama's agenda is in going to Kenya and Ethiopia right now.
President Obama has been to Africa 3 or 4 times before. Nonetheless, there's a perception on the continent that he is more interested in other geopolitical regions throughout the world other than the African continent, even though he has historical roots in Kenya. His father was born there. Also, he is supposed to speak at the African Union headquarters in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia, the first time he's ever done that. And there's been a lot of criticism on the African continent that the regional organization for Africa, which has 54 member states, has been sidestepped and ignored in regard to U.S.-Africa relations. I think his purpose is to an attempt to, in a sense, reclaim some of the focus of U.S. Foreign policy towards Africa, because, quite frankly, the People's Republic of China and other states throughout the world have had more direct and on-the-ground practical experience in Africa during his administration than the U.S. has. I'm not saying that the U.S. is totally disengaged from Africa. They're very much involved militarily, but in regard to economic relationships and economic models that may be beneficial to the African nation states, the U.S. Has taken a back seat to China.
And let's talk about the situation in Somalia. How has a U.S. policy in the region contributed to the fragmentation of Somalia?
In December of 2006, at the aegis of the previous George W. Bush administration, the government in Ethiopia, which is heavily allied with the United States, intervened in Somalia to put down the burgeoning influence of the Islamic Courts Union. Some 2 years later, they were able to broker a deal with the Islamic Courts Union, but it left out al-Shabaab, which is the youth wing of the ICU, the previous ICU. And they have attempted to isolate al-Shabaab. And in our opinion, that was a great diplomatic blunder in regard to any attempt to stabilize the situation inside of Somalia, which has been highly contentious over the last 30 years. So I think that in that regard, the U.S. has committed a grave error. The African Union mission to Somalia, AMISOM, is highly financed and coordinated and trained by the United States and the European Union. They have some 22,000 troops occupying the country, largely centered around Mogadishu, the capital. But it is still not totally stabilized, the situation in Somalia. And the conflict in Somalia has spilled over into Kenya, because you have ethnic Somalians who are in Kenya.